We will have Bob Park, who is the director of the, the chair of the Prairie Social Action Committee, introduce our speaker for today. Bob?
Pleasure to welcome our speaker. Robert Martin belongs to the Macaque Indian tribe of the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, the most northwesterly point of the continental United States. He was an ombudsman and independent watchdog to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for a period of 9 years stretching from the first Bush administration to the present one. He advocated for citizens in pollution cases such as those involving Superfund sites where the land is contaminated with toxic waste. He resigned in 2002 after EPA officials under the current administration decided to reassign him to a position that he believed undermined his ability to determine which cases of alleged EPA impropriety to investigate. He is here to talk to us today about the ongoing major rollback of environmental protections at the national level under our current president's administration, something that also concerns me as someone who works for the state Environmental Protection Agency. Welcome, Robert Martin.
Good morning. Good to see you. It's good to be here. I've been in Wisconsin now just over a week, and it's been a wonderful experience. I don't know if I met some of you on the way into Madison last Friday night, but I really enjoyed my time here. And you can thank Mr. Paul Wozniak for being very persuasive about coming up to Wisconsin and speaking. And thank even more my wife Paula, who's from Wisconsin. And I'd never really been up to the state. We just got married a year and a half ago. Thought it was high time to meet the rest of the family. So it's been very good. And I am here this morning to tell you a story. And really, it's my own story of my own experience as the what became known as the National Ombudsman for the United States Environmental Protection Agency. It's not that I was the only one. There were some others, I think, for business and asbestos. But I was the one that Congress made back in the 80s, and that's the job I took. Now, I don't know if any of you know what an ombudsman is. I didn't. I learned pretty quickly after taking the position. Ombudsman is an old Swedish word which means a person who stands between the king and the governed. And it's an institution in the Scandinavian nations that goes back 4 or 5 centuries. We don't have any kings, I think, in the United States. I think the last one was another guy named King George in Great Britain. That's the nature of the job, ombudsman, somebody who stands between the people of the United States and, let's just say, the senior management of the Environmental Protection Agency. And there are a lot of programs in EPA. I mean, there's air, there's water, there's pesticides. But the one I had the most to do with was what's known as the Superfund program. Does everyone know what the Superfund program is? Well, I think it's mostly known now for no longer being super. It had, at one time, a great deal of money. It was made in 1980 under the administration of President Carter. And the thinking back then was that there were some very urgent situations to deal with in different parts of the country, like Love Canal, New York, where most of the town was contaminated. If we just had this mechanism, response mechanism, with a lot of money in it, we could throw it at those situations and fix it pretty quickly. And I think the thinking also was that we probably didn't have more than a few dozen such situations in the country. Well, that was wrong. As many of you know, by the later 80s, we came to find that there were many thousands of these situations all over the United States. In fact, EPA reliably estimates that approximately 1 out of 4 Americans live within a toxic site 5 to 10 miles. And that's a very high average. So you get a appreciation then for what it meant to have the job. Somebody who stands between the people and management, and a lot of people being affected by these kinds of sites all over the country. And what I'd like to do is just offer you a few case stories to understand what it meant to have the position and go in and out of communities. And I know the title of the talk is Rollback at the National Level, but you know, we really feel the rollbacks mostly at the community level. That's been my experience. I mean, we can all read papers and talk about what's going on in the world and around the country, but it really affects us where we live. And my job was to really drop in with people where they live. What helped me do that was something called a toll-free number. I still remember it to this day. 1-800-262-7937. And anyone in the country could call that number. It was a guy in the street or a guy in Congress. And everyone did. I think in my tenure, which was almost 10 years, I probably got between 50 and 80,000 calls on that line. Now, that didn't mean that everyone who called, you know, was presenting some kind of crisis. Often it was, I just need to know. I just want to talk about it. Can you listen to me? Or can you give me information? Or can you show me where I should go? And that was most of those calls. And those are important calls. And there were times, however, when the calls were presenting a crisis. And those crises I often called cases, ombudsman cases. And I often did cases in matters of great controversy. Use the entire communities having a need, multiple companies, great liability, terrible health effects, or lots of money involved, or all the above. And those usually wound up to be ombudsman cases. And those are important because they were done with independence. And that's a word that is fast going out of vogue in the government today. I think it's very important. My job description with the Environmental Protection Agency pretty much said, do it with maximum independence. And I think that was of value to the American community. So one of the first cases I got involved in was a lady from Houston, Texas. She lived next to a subdivision where they had a number of birth defects among children in a very short time period. Very rare defects, the kind that could not be, let's just say, statistically explained, given their incidence. And there is a Superfund site called BRIO, B-R-I-O, next to the subdivision. It's a pretty good one. Lots of pits and lots of liquid waste was put into the pits by, let's just say, different Fortune 500 companies, among them Monsanto. And she was concerned that the plan to take care of this was going to be more dangerous than the site itself. The site was pretty dangerous as it stood. The plan was to burn the waste, burn it in a high temperature incinerator right on site and right next to the subdivision. So Ree Flickinger, that was SPM down near Houston, felt that the cure is going to be worse than the disease and asked me to take a case. It was my first case. And I remember how it came up because she was pretty burned out. She'd been confronting and struggling with not only the agency, but these different companies for many years about the proper way to take care of the site. She's about ready to give up. And she had a bunch of documents from EPA. Citizens are often forced to get all that for themselves and read it, try and understand it. She was getting into the car, opened the door, and something dropped out. And that day, she was ready to give up. But what dropped out on a piece of paper and fell on the ground, she picked it up and read it, was the toll-free number. And Marie will tell you the story herself probably better than I can. I think it's also in the Molly Ivins book called Bushwhack, chapter 7. So she called, and she gave me her argument. Well, I don't know that I can agree with them up front, but I will do this. I'll take the case. 28 versions of a report later, or 28 drafts that I worked on with EPA, and countless meetings with the responsible companies and the community, including a hearing we did right next to the site, also right next to this big community college and hospital. I agree with Maria. I felt the cure was going to be worse than the disease. And I recommended that we recharacterize the site entirely. I characterize as kind of a term of art in the EPA for looking at a toxic site. It's how you see the problem, you know, how you see the problem, and then how you develop what it really is so that you can understand what the best way to clean it up is. And I didn't feel we did that well enough. And I thought that we relied too much on the company's people in our vision and understanding of what to do. Well, it turned out that you couldn't really walk on the site and do work on the site without causing a release into the air. It was bad soil gas on the site. And in digging to put up this incinerator, even guys in what's known as full protective clothing, the stuff that would be released into the air actually went through one guy's equipment, his suit, causing what's known as an IDLH, immediate danger to life and health situation. Well, after that, the company saw Marie's way and said, you know, they called her and said, you know, okay, it's over. We agree with you. We agree with the community. We don't think we should do this. But it was because of the ombudsman process where we all dropped in and were willing to ask questions and talk about it that opened up the path. So they agreed. And initially, EPA didn't want to change it, even though the companies and the community all came in together, sat across the table from the EPA and said, stop. This incinerator was supposed to open up very shortly. Stop. It's not safe. But again, because of the process, the agency agreed. I think they call it new information after the IDLH incident. And that was a great victory for the community. The incinerator was set to be turned on in 3 days. And it didn't. It didn't turn on. And they have to walk away from the equivalent of a $45 to $50 million investment in that unit. But you know, it was the kind of thing that if it were not looked at hard and based on facts and good technical information changed, it would have been a great danger in the community. So, on to the next case. Predominantly, in fact, an entirely African-American community in Pensacola, Florida, had been living in between two toxic sites for many years, and probably 100 years. And that was so, I think, in the first instance, because of a legacy of segregation. And then simply because over two or three generations, everybody worked there. And they weren't paid well enough to get out, so they couldn't get out. The facilities got abandoned, and as they were abandoned, lots of waste got left. The agency decided to excavate one of the sites to see if they could begin to clean it up. Started digging a hole on a site called the Escambias. And we're hoping to hit clean. We didn't hit clean. And we had a big hole. Even more importantly, we had a big pile. A big pile of dirt in the hole. And the pile of dirt became the highest point in the state of Florida. That's how much dirt got taken out. And it did not get put back in the hole because we ran out of money. This is the removal, you can get into the ins and the outs of the Superfund program, but this is the part of the program where you're limited by dollars and you're limited by time. We ran out of dollars and time. And this was left. This was left right next to this African-American community. And that pile became known as Mount Dioxin. Because it was full of dioxin, which is a carcinogenic substance. And I remember getting called by Margaret Williams, who was a retired school teacher, where I would still battling away leading the community in Pensacola. And she said, Mr. Martin, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We'd like to trust that the government is going to make the right decision in the right time to take this away. But in the meantime, we're dying. Every day, dirt from that pile blows into our residences and yards, and it's full of contamination, and people are dying. Will you take the case? Yeah, I'll take the case. So I came down and went from house to house, and met with a lot of families. And sure enough, the proximity of someone's yard to Mount Dioxin wasn't much further than this room to that room. It was extremely close. And not just one or two houses, it was many houses. So, one of the first things I thought we should do was look at this neighborhood in a different way. We didn't have good sampling. We didn't know, in my opinion, what we needed to know. So I recommended we do a thorough sampling program. And the EPA agreed. And the sampling did show that there was different kinds of contaminants in people's residences and homes and yards. And on the strength of the sampling, I then recommended to management that we move permanently, not temporarily, that we move them away. Literally, in my opinion, to save lives. Now, this was not a popular recommendation because EPA does not often move people permanently. I think the agency likes to think and believe that you can do the job in such a way, in such a time, that you don't have to move people away. Move them away for a little while and move back, but in this case, it was very bad. In fact, it's only happened a dozen times in the history of the agency, I think, or so, that people have been moved in such a way. Well, they agreed, and that became one of the hallmark, what's known as environmental justice cases in the 1990s, the experience of that community in Pensacola, Florida. On to a predominantly Hispanic community in a little town called McFarland, north of Bakersfield, California, in the lower San Joaquin Valley. Community leader there, Marta Simmons, had reported that there had been a couple of cancer clusters among very young children. And the folks there were predominantly agricultural workers, huge agricultural regions, had been exposed over time to significant amounts of pesticides. And something else known as a pesticide drift, because their homes are right next to the field. And every time you get spraying of pesticides in great amounts, it would literally drift into where they lived. Not only in the air, but I found out there were pesticides in the water, pesticides in the soil. I thought we should have a look. I went into that town. I remember it to this day. Marta and I would visit families that had cancer in their families. As we were doing so, we were followed from block to block by people in nondescript white vehicles with black smoke flasks. Every time we'd visit a home, they'd pull up about a block away and wait. We'd come out. The next home, next one, next one, next one. Okay, we're being watched. To this day, I don't know. I don't know who was in those vehicles. But it didn't feel safe. I visited our region, EPA Region 9 in San Francisco. EPA is broken up into 10 regions around the country. Your region's Region 5 in Chicago. So I visited Region 9 and met with government at all levels, the region, to the state of California, to the county. You know, this is a tough one, but I think we should build it. There had been some studies in the past by the state and by the county, but they were inconclusive. And the kids were still getting cancer. And it wasn't just kids, it was adults. And even beyond the cancers, there were non-cancer health effects in the community from exposure to pesticides. And I recommended we do so. The region agreed. the regional administrator of EPA Region 9 in Reno. I remember what shall be an anonymous conversation at that time. Somebody told me, you know, if we go in, we're going to find something. I'm with you. Well, if we find something, we're going to have to do something. And I'm still with you. Well, if we do something here, we're going to have to do something in another place, in another community. Because it's not just this community in California. Well, okay. Isn't that why we're here? Isn't that why we're here? Well, yeah, but the manpower and resources. I know, we don't have enough. But let's say so. Let's just say so. Let's tell the public. Let's tell the people. We have a problem here. We have a problem there. We can only do so much. But we're going to call it as we see it. Well, in that instance, we did. And just before going in, the city manager made a call to the regional management and said, you know, if you folks come in, we cannot guarantee your safety. And the region hired private security as we went back into the community. We had, in fact, personal bodyguards to do that job. And that's how sharp that case was. EPA then agreed to do a very comprehensive sampling program of air, water, and land. The air portion was just finished, I think, last year. It was all in response to the ombudsman case and recommendations. So you begin to get an appreciation for what it meant to have a position that people could call upon when needed for a more independent look at problems in their neighborhoods. I'll give you a couple more and then try and get to the end quickly of the story. St. Louis, Missouri. There was a case there called the Times Beach case. And I think about 24 towns in eastern Missouri had been contaminated with dioxin. Why? Because oil used to be used to throw down on roads to keep dust from moving around. And in the oil was dioxin. Now you got that spread all over eastern Missouri. A great deal of it was in the abandoned town of Pines Beach, Missouri. And the plan to take care of this, again, was to burn it in an incinerator in Pines Beach. And it was sold because no one was living there anymore. It had been permanently relocated. But you still have people living not too far away, you know, from that place. I think there was even a Six Flags in Texas or something like that, amusement park a mile or two away. I got called into that one by Congressman James Talent, who's now Senator Talent of Missouri. And I remember he said, you know, I'm not known as an environmentalist, but I don't like being lied to. And I've been lied to, and my people have been lied to. And I want you to go in and help understand whether this is being done safely or not. And I'm willing to live with it either way. But it's got to be you. All right. So it was operating midstream. And again, the ombudsman process was open and transparent. I asked for a lot of documents from our EPA Region 7. They were provided. I asked a lot of questions. They were answered. The company also cooperated. Heard from all kinds of people in eastern Missouri. I had a comment period of 30 days, 30 days only. Tell me what you think. I had a stack of material this day, all over my desk. Letters, emails, here's what I think, here's my concern. Well, what I found most compelling as I did this was some information by some local citizens. And they found out that the known as the chain of custody around some samples for picture a big incineration unit that burns dirt. Well, it was a stack. Stuff can come out of the stack. Something known as a dioxin stack test, by which you measure how much dioxin is coming out of
chain of custody for testing that stack. They told me it was suspect. So I got a lot of information and evidence. I looked at that. And sure enough, the samples, the dioxin stack guns, which allowed this place to go into operation, was compromised. And it, by compromised, I mean seals can't be broken, okay, on samples, on tubes. If seals are broken, it's not a good thing. It means it's a compromise. Holding times have to be observed for samples. If you go beyond a specific holding time, the sample's not good anymore. And most importantly, to know who got something in the first place and then who got it in the second place. If you have a sample and you give it to somebody else, you have to sign for it. You have to initial it. That wasn't done. And in the end, you determine that samples had gone home to somebody over Thanksgiving and wound their way up in a basement. You got to the lab too late. So on the basis of that, I recommended we retest the entire facility and bring in a team outside of the region to do the test. Because there is no other way anyone I felt could have confidence in the integrity of this operation. And that's exactly what the agency did. Moving on to Denver, Colorado, something called the Shattuck Chemical Site. Radioactive waste at the Shattuck Chemical Site. And EPA originally decided to move it out. That was the remedy. They then reversed that decision and decided to leave it. It was at that point that I was contacted, not only by folks in the neighborhood, but people in the elected leadership of Colorado. A very conservative governor and U.S. senator, and a very liberal U.S. representative and mayor. All asked me, and to make a long story short, the key questions there, if you're going to leave radioactive waste in the city limits, are, will it work, and for how long? Whereas, will it be protective of human health and the environment, and for how long? Well, this decision was sold as being protective for 1,000 years. And when you think about it, that's the history of the Roman Empire. That's a long time. Okay, let's look at that. So we had public hearings. We took testimony from everyone. And I do mean everyone, including the company. And also, most importantly, we had a team come in, the same team that helped me in Texas and in St. Louis, called the Environmental Response Team. They're part of EPA, except they're independent of the regions. A small team of experts, and they troubleshoot all over the country for the agency. Led by a man named Dr. Joe Laffineri. And said, Joe, can you look at this for me and tell me? And are you willing to tell everyone publicly? She said, yeah, I am. So he looked at it. He testified. And I remember that hearing. He was in a little church in the community. And I said, you know, what do you think? He said, it'll work. It'll work for 5 to 7 years. And I think at that time you could hear a pin drop. You could hear a pin drop in that church and write yourself. So there the recommendation was to get it out. And the agency did that. Now, you can get a feeling for these different cases. I think by the time I resigned I had something like 40 or so. There were a lot of them. It was getting a bit much to do on my own, and I pretty much did it on my own. I had a lot of help at times from the Environmental Response Team, which would give me technical advice, and also a couple of fellows that EPA would allow to help me from time to time. My position description didn't allow me to supervise anyone at EPA, so I couldn't hire anyone. I didn't have a large staff. I had some college interns, and I had some retired people. And as the importance of this function became more apparent, Congress ordered kind of a job review, which I felt was appropriate. The General Accounting Office, which works for Congress and reports to Congress on management capabilities, did a report over about a year and a half of how I did the ombudsman job. And this is around the year 2000, 2001. Well, they concluded a lot of different things. This is all publicly available. It's a very big document. The two biggest things they concluded was this function needs more independence, not less. And it needs more support, not less. Okay? Those were the two main conclusions. That also inspired legislation to be introduced in Congress in both the Senate and the House to accomplish just that. Administration has changed. We have now left the Clinton administration. We are now in the administration of President George Bush, W. Bush. Christine Todd Whitman is confirmed as administrator of the agency. And what lies before her, among many, many other things, is what to do Ombudsman function, because the GIO have done its work. They did their evaluation. All in the administrator's court. Well, I heard a rumor when I was in the agency that she was going to fold what I did into what's known as the Office of Inspector General. And I didn't feel that would be a good thing to do. I felt it would be the end of an independent ombudsman function for different communities to fold my job into that office. I just didn't feel it worked. Number one, legally, because the IG can't do any programmatic responsibilities of the EPA. And the ombudsman function was a programmatic responsibility. Legally, they can't work things out. They can investigate waste, fraud, and abuse, but usually that goes to money matters in the EPA of waste, fraud, and abuse. And I remember them being asked before Congress, after I resigned, they had hearings about my leaving. I went and testified. I was asked, do I think the IG can do my job? No, I don't. I don't think they can do it legally, and I don't think they can do it practically. One of the biggest things around my job was, I don't want to use the word secretive, but it's definitely, there's an element of it which is behind closed doors. It's way different. So anyway, this prompted me to write the administrator, which I did not often do. And this is around, I think, September of 2001, very close to September 11th. I said, you know, I respect your authority. I respect the office of administrator. I respect you have the authority to decide what to do. But whatever you do, don't do that. Because if you do that, it will be the end. Ombudsman function that works for the American people. I got a note, a personal note, from the administrator around November of 2001. Very short, very brief. This is before me for decision making. I will decide. Well, I heard several days later that she had decided to do exactly that, to fold the ombudsman function into the Inspector General's office. I heard it because I was getting calls from different congressional offices. Teams had been sent to brief and to let them know that this was the decision. I wasn't told what it was. So I remember going in, I had a meeting with a senior management official at EPA. I said, maybe I want to hear it from you. You're management, so why don't you tell me what's going on? I said, well, that's the decision. Effective January 10th, 2002. And I said, okay, well, I got some questions, because the GIO says more independence, not less. More support, not less. More authority, not less. So will I be able to fire people? No. Will I be able to fire people? No. Will I be able to choose my own cases, because I have for 9 years? Will I be able to say there's a problem? Oh, not at all. I don't have any more questions. So I went back to my desk, and it was a hard day. I think this was November 27, 2001. And I wrote for the second time. And I said, I have to oppose you. I wrote her for the second time. I said, I have to oppose you, because this is bad. And I will use every legal remedy available to do so. This was difficult, because all I had done for many years was try troubleshoot for the government, and B, in effect, their quality assurance, quality control act. And all of a sudden, that middle ground is gone. Okay. Well, after that, I think a number of members of the House of Representatives wrote her, I think as many as 28, everyone from Charlie Rangel in Harlem to a guy named Butch Potter in Idaho. But don't do it. Don't do it until we can have hearings in the House and talk about it. They weren't listened to. They were ignored. A number of Republican senators then wrote her and said, don't do it until we can have hearings in the Senate. They weren't heeded either. And three different communities in different states of the country here, Idaho, Pennsylvania, Florida, actually then went to court and asked for injunctions to stop it. Instead of sitting down with them, the Justice Department was sent to defend the cases. And it became clear to me as January 10th was getting closer and closer that this really wasn't going to stop. So I was out in Denver meeting with the community there, and I decided to authorize a lawsuit to be filed against Christine Todd Whitman. And the lawsuit's basis was the free speech provision of the United States Constitution. We filed it. A judge in Washington, D.C. Gave a hearing almost the next day. It was Judge Richard Roberts. It was January 10th. And he heard the case. And the government came in and argued, well, you know what I argued, free speech, the need for this function for the American people. The government argued doing this would make for a stronger ombudsman. Well, that day, the judge saw it free speech day, and he awarded a temporary restraining order against Christine Todd Whitman from coming anywhere near me or the office. That was a shock, I think. And it is definitely a strange feeling to go to work under the protection of a temporary restraining order. Nonetheless, it was important that it was issued because it gave time. It gave time to do virtually one last case that some other good folks in the agency were working on, including Ken Jenkins in India. Ground zero, the World Trade Center. Normally, a temporary restraining order lasts days. This one lasted months. And because of the time it provided, I had the window I needed to go up and do two 12-hour hearings near Ground Zero with Congressman Gerald Nadler, who represents Lower Manhattan. And I heard in those hearings, which actually could have gone on far longer, they simply ended after 12 hours because we couldn't keep our heads up anymore. We heard from a lot of people. We heard from firefighters, we heard from cops, we heard from rescue workers, sanitation workers going 24/7 to get debris out of Ground Zero, residents, artists, all kinds of folks. I asked EPA to come and testify. Every time I did a hearing, I asked the agency to come. Every time they did, except in the case of Ground Zero. There, the administration said it was nothing but pure theater, or high theater, or something like that. Well, definitely off-Broadway was the remark. Well, I thought it was insulting to the people of New York who were pouring out their stories. Not only their stories, but also some initial scientific evidence about what had happened after the towers in New York came down, the environmental aftermath, the terrorist attack at the World Trade Center. We had quite a bit of information, some of it from Dr. Jenkins, some of it from other scientists. One of them who came forward publicly to testify was Dr. Cahill, Paul Cahill. He led a team known as the Delta Team, and they actually worked for the government. They worked for different agencies of the government over a period of years, troubleshot major disasters, like Hoyt oil field. In fact, they had done that after the end of the first Gulf War. And Dr. Cahill testified that based on his quick look after the towers came down, they set up an air monitoring network on different buildings in Lower Manhattan, that the quality of the air over Lower Manhattan was worse than the Hoyt oil field fires after the end of the first Gulf War. This is very troubling. And also spoke about other issues, such as the pH level in the air, which is thought to be between 11 and 13. It's very caustic to breathe. He had a deeper concern for something known as very fine particles that were in the air after the towers came down, at the micron and submicron level, which if breathed would lodge themselves in the lower respiratory tract. Not going to happen. So, if you're going to be near ground zero or work at ground zero, it kind of follows that you would want to have proper protective equipment, respirators, things like that. Notwithstanding that, there's a statement by the administrator several days after the towers came down that the air was safe to breathe, and water was safe to drink, and the earthers did not have those concerns about the environment after the fall of the towers, 3 days after they came down. It was also revealed by even the Inspector General, I think as late as last fall, that the administration, White House, had a role in editing press releases, which were issued about the dangers posed by falling of the tower at ground zero. I can say, hearing different cops and firefighters, that they were puzzled. They just didn't know. I mean, they're there working day and night. They heard assuring statements from the government. But then they also were confronting this horrific situation at ground zero and wondering why, at least in the people who came forward to us, the respirators were not freely available for everyone who was working on site. In fact, there was a sergeant who led the Sergeants Association of the NYPD who testified that there were many, many respirators in the armory just a few blocks away, but they never got them. So, it was a bad situation. I was in the process of making preliminary recommendations on what to do in New York, always feeling that I was racing against time to do so, knowing that the TRO was not going to last. In fact, a hearing on preliminary injunction was called in the court, and I had to show up. So did the government. And I remember sitting there. And I was surprised to see the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Affairs of the United States government walk into Portland to argue the case personally. That the restraining order should be lifted and the ombudsman function should be sent to the Office of Inspector General. And I, you know, am not an expert on constitutional law. Here's what I heard in the argument to the judge and the Assistant Attorney General. This government speaks with one voice, and one voice only. There can only be one voice. And this function belongs in the IG. So lift it, and let's get it over. And I remember the judge had some good questions. The judge said, you know, all right, I understand national security. I understand that the government has authority over its employees. I get all that. I get, you know, this man is an employee of the federal government. But he's not just any employee, he's the ombudsman. He's the ombudsman for this program in the agency. And it's his job. I've got a position restriction here. He's to be maximally independent and listen to the people and intercede for the people. So I got a few questions. will this man be able to continue to talk to members of Congress as he has in the past? The answer was no. Will he be able to continue to talk to the press in this country as he has in the past? And the answer was no. Will he be able to continue to talk to citizens when they bring problems to him and make decisions about whether they become cases? The answer was no. And it was at that point I realized that the weight of the government at this time was entirely against an independent ombudsman function. And I remember the judge looking down and saying, you know, I'm going to have to think about this. Like you to waive any objections and continue this restraining order for a week or two while I'm delivering. And he didn't hear anything. And we looked up and said, I'm waiting. I'm waiting for your answer. And the Assistant Attorney General said, no. And I said, why not? And there are a lot of people in the courtroom that day from New York who come down. I know they're all looking at each other because they're wondering what's going to happen to their case. And he said, I'm not authorized to. And I know a lot of folks looked at each other that morning and wondered who was. Okay. So the judge nonetheless extended it for a week or two. And I went back up to New York at the request of the legislature to make some very early recommendations on what to do. Ground zero. My recommendations were very general. They went to the need to be more thorough in an understanding of the spread of contamination in Lower Manhattan. To go beyond ground zero and look in people's homes, look at businesses and schools. I had some, I guess you could say it, the very basic concerns. Looking at how the towers came down, you only have to wonder how many light bulbs are in the towers. Mm-hmm. What's some light bulbs? You have to wonder how many computers came down with the destruction of the towers, and how much lead is in a single computer, and then how all that would fall into one place and hook incompletely, burn incompletely at ground zero. There are different ways, I'm sure, to register these concerns scientifically, and they have been. But these were my concerns. And I felt we didn't do enough. That we weren't thorough enough. So I recommended we go back in and do that kind of program. While I was there, the judge was approached to lift the restraining order to send my case to what's known as another venue. Let's move it to another venue. On the argument that certain administrative remedies had not been exhausted. Like on a Friday at around 3 o'clock or something. And he did. And what I understand, I think I've seen the email, is the Office of Administrator then communicated to the Office of Inspector General, and it was pretty much along the lines of move now. And within about a 5-day span, as many as 28 people from that office moved into mine and took all the files. Changed the locks, removed the hard drives from the computers, pulled the phones, and took the word ombudsman off the door. That was a hard weekend. Things like that don't usually happen in government on a weekend, as many of you can appreciate. It was a hard weekend because I then had to decide what to do. I didn't decide it alone, but in the end, of course, it was my decision. I resigned the following Monday, which was Earth Day 2002. It just happened to fall on Earth Day 2002. And I remember that morning, I called my secretary, this old retired lady named Louise, it's very sweet and wonderful. You know, Louise, I need to tell you what I've decided to do. And she said, well, there's four gentlemen here, the Inspector General, and they're They're waiting to escort you to where you're supposed to go, and I don't know where that is right now. So we'll tell them I've resigned. And I left because I felt it would be a betrayal, not only of everything I believed in to stay and to go there, but that I would also be betraying the communities around this country that had placed a trust in an independent ombudsman function, because that didn't exist anymore. So whatever happened after that, I pretty much told them, you're going to have to do it. I won't cooperate. And that's the story. Thank you.
Citizens Coalition in New York, 911 Coalition, that has been directly affected by Ground Zero, and they have collected all kinds of information available on the internet to anyone who wants to know. Speaking, I think perhaps writing, and what I would very much like to do is continue work directly with the communities I was privileged to know. And. I have actually an editorial I'd like to read. It's very brief, but it was written in a bastion of liberalism known as Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And that it could be a good way to, I think, close out at least this talk.
This editorial was written on Earth Day 2004. It's titled Earth Day, Two Steps Back for the Environment. And it's in the Oshkosh Northwestern. I met with their editorial board several days ago. Yet another Earth Day will pass today with the environment of the state and nation less protected than it was just a decade ago. This is because one of the most important tools for a private citizen in environmental protection continues to be denied. It's politically in vogue to close the offices of ombudsmen, occupied by people who keep environmental agencies honest with their own rules and regulations. Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson ended this state's position in 1995, and the federal government axed its position in 2002. None of us are the better for it. The former EPA ombudsman under three presidents, Robert Martin, visited Oshkosh in the Northwestern this week to highlight what the public loses without this position. The loss is so huge that both the federal and state government should reinstate this important position. Ombudsmen work to hold environmental agencies accountable. It's only right that an agency that enforces strict regulations should have to be held to exacting standards too. The people need someone who can handle complaints about environmental regulations. An environmental agency can make bad decisions. It can also worsen one with inaction. The loss of ombudsmen means an agency becomes focused on preserving its image of itself. It becomes more politically susceptible. That's how both our federal and state ombudsmen disappeared. Politics pressure cooked their positions. Then EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman slowly worked to reduce Martin's responsibilities until merging the office illegally into the EPA's Office of Inspector General. Congress complained, but nothing changed. The Wisconsin Kellett Commission created the Office of Public Intervenor in 1967 to make government more effective. It operated under the State Department of Justice with powers to sue the government. Governor Tommy Thompson decided to remove the office in his 1995 budget. He stripped it of its power to sue. In both cases, government harmed itself with these actions due to another invaluable function of the ombudsman that can be measured. Simply put, bad environmental decisions cost money and lives. Government by ombudsman is government willing to be held accountable. Government without ombudsman is government that wants to thwart environmental agencies from operating at their best. Wisconsin and the federal government should make a leap for environmental progress. They should restore their respective offices of the ombudsman.